I'm going to be talking about, I don't know what, labor economics, I guess, yeah, from an Austrian point of view, because I'm an Austrian. But Austrian economics isn't really that different from the mainstream on labor economics. Austrians are much different on many other things, certainly capital theory, interest rates, business cycles. But we're enough different so that this will be somewhat different than the mainstream presentation. I'm going to do what's called a cadenza in music, where Mozart writes a piece, and there are 10 or 12 bars where the soloist is supposed to just talk, or not talk, but play on the basis of what went before. So I'm sort of going to pre-associate and just sort of babble about economics for 45 minutes. And then hopefully we'll have some questions and discussion and objections, perhaps, whatever. Okay, well, the first thing I should address is how to end unemployment in one day. I don't want to be accused of false advertising, and this was sort of a hook to get people into being interested in this webinar. And it's sort of silly. You really can't end unemployment in one day. Except if you declare the death penalty for unemployment. And anyone who says that they're unemployed is subject to the death penalty, and I don't think anyone's going to say that they're unemployed. And if they do, we kill them. So there'll be nobody left who says, yes, I'm unemployed. And the way they count unemployed is you're actively seeking a job and not finding one, and no one will admit that. They'll either say they're not seeking one, or they'll say, I've got one, and maybe they can buddy up, and each one says, well, yeah, I'm hiring him, and he's hiring me, so neither of us are unemployed. So that's sort of, I don't know, not really serious economics. As I say, it was sort of a hook to get people interested in this. I think it would work, literally. I mean, if we had the death penalty for unemployed people, I would expect we'd have zero unemployed people. Whether because they wouldn't admit it, or we'd kill them if they admitted it, and then that would end them. Okay, so let's get to a more serious way of looking at it. Why do we have work in the first place? Why do we have to work? Why don't we just sit and, I don't know, cogitate and enjoy life? And the reason we have to work is because we don't live in an era of scarcity. We do live in an era of scarcity. If there were no scarcity, that means that manna was falling down from heaven, only not just in the form of food, but toys, bicycles, Maseratis, whatever we wanted, a Rolex, then we wouldn't have to work. We wouldn't have scarcity. We wouldn't have to work. Everything would be cool. And indeed, that is the ideal where economics is heading, or hopefully. I mean, the ideal of dentistry is an end to tooth decay. The ideal of medicine is no one gets sick. The ideal of, I don't know what, accounting is that we can have magical accounting. Well, the ideal of economics is to get rid of scarcity. And every time we invent something, or work harder, or smarter, or faster, or have less government interfering with us, so we get closer to post-scarcity. There are really two ways to get rid of scarcity. One is to want less. That would be the Gandhi way, where he wanted very little. But for most of us, the way to get rid of it or move in that direction is to have more stuff, get richer, have more wealth. So the reason we have to work is because we still have scarcity. We haven't succeeded in the economic goal. Well, why do we have jobs? Given that we have to work, why don't we work for ourselves? Each one work in his own little house and produce shoes or something like that. The reason we get together with firms is because of specialization and division of labor. It's much more efficient to work together. The capitalist gives something to the worker. Why workers don't get together in communal syndicals or syndics or whatever you call them. What the capitalist gives to the workers is three things. First, he gives them time. If the workers were going to get together and produce something for themselves, let's say they were going to produce pens like this. I'm waving around a pen. Can anyone see it? Yeah, I can see it, so maybe you can see it. Well, in order to make these pens, what you have to do is get a factory, You have to get machines, and you have to get the raw material of which this pen is made. And let's say it'll take a year, just to pick an arbitrary time period, between the time that we, the workers, get an idea to build the pen factory, and before the first pen comes trotting off the assembly line, and we have then we have pens that we can sell. Well, let's say it takes a year. If there were no capitalist who was employing the workers, what would the workers do for salary for a year? Well, they'd have to live on past savings. And what would they do to get the money to get the raw materials and the machinery and rent the building or create the building? Well, again, savings. And a lot of workers don't have that much savings. So the first thing that the entrepreneur gives to the workers is he gives them a year's worth of money to support them and to get them the raw materials with which to work, and otherwise they'd have to pay it for themselves. So that's one thing that he contributes. Another thing is risk. He bears the risk. He's the residual income claimant, it's called. If the pens sell, he gets all the money, and you know he still has to pay wages. But suppose the pens don't sell. Suppose blue pens are, in a year from now, nobody wants blue pens, or nobody wants pens, or for whatever reason, they just don't sell. He can't go back to the workers and say, hey, workers, or as in Brooklyn, they say, wikers, hey, wikers, guess what, the pens didn't sell, so I've got to get back that year's salary that I gave you. No, he's bearing the risk. So the capitalist is making that contribution also, and third, he initiates things, he's the entrepreneur, the leader. So that would be sort of the justification, or at least an explanation of why he is the residual income claimant, because he is bringing that to the table, so to speak. Okay, so we now know why we have to work, scarcity. We now know why we work for other people, as in jobs employed by firms or entrepreneurs. Why do we have unemployment? Well, the way I see it, I could be wrong, I'll be corrected during the question period maybe, is there are two sources of unemployment. One is legitimate cause of unemployment, namely change. Any change will create unemployment given that we don't have instantaneous adjustment. And the second one is government intervention that screws up the market. Well, let's take the first one first. Let's suppose that, somebody invents the computer. And there are a lot of people working in typewriter factories. For those of you who are too young to know what a typewriter is, it looks just like a keyboard, only instead of a screen, you have like little keys that hit paper. It's weird, amazing stuff. Or to take another case, when the automobile first came in, the horse and buggy industry had a lot of horse breakers and horse trainers and bridle makers and who are the people that make the horseshoes, blacksmiths and whip makers and just all sorts of people in the horse and buggy industry, carriage makers. And let's say the car comes in. Do all these workers instantaneously get into car factories? No. There's no such thing as instantaneous adjustment. So even without evil government creating unemployment problems, and I'll get to that in a minute, every time there's change, there'll be some unemployment. Namely, the people in the typewriter factories, or the people in the horse and buggy industry, or the people in whatever industry is now being supplanted by something else, whether a new invention or imports or something, well, they have to go and get a job somewhere else. Now, they don't necessarily have to get a job in the computer industry as for typewriter people, nor do the people in a horse and buggy industry, we have to get a job in the automobile industry, but a lot of people have to lose jobs in typewriters or horses and buggies, and a lot of people have to get jobs in computers or cars. The same people don't have to go from A to B. They could go from A to B to C or something like that. Namely, the people in the typewriter industry could become plumbers, and some of the plumbers then could be going into computers, to pick an example. But the point is that when you get one industry replacing another industry, and thousands and thousands, or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in these industries losing their jobs, they can't instantaneously get other jobs, whether in the new industry or in some other industries. So it takes time. And as long as the government isn't slowing down this transition, well, then it's not going to take a lot of time. Well, I shouldn't say that. To some people, it's going to take an awful lot of time. Like, suppose somebody is 50 years old or 60 years old, and it's harder to train old coots like me. I'm 70, and I'm still working. And, you know, if I were working in the typewriter or horse and buggy industry, I might have a hard time getting any other job, and maybe I'll be unemployed for the rest of my life. I don't know. So any change conceivably could have devastating long-run unemployment effects on some people who are inflexible, and on other people, maybe they could quickly switch from one to another or from A to B and then to C. So it's hard to say, but when the free enterprise system is in operation and the government isn't slowing down the transition period, well, then that's the market. Okay, so one cause of unemployment is just changes. Any sort of change, you know, people switch from pizza to burgers or burgers to pizza. And I mean, there's no new innovation. We had burgers and we have pizza now. But if tastes change from the one to the other, and we have to close down Burger King and Wendy's and McDonald's and start opening Domino's and other pizza places or vice versa, people will have to leave one sort of employment and get into another sort of employment, and that takes time. More time for some people, less time for other people. Some people, no time at all. They can just do it almost instantaneously, and other people can never do it. So that's the market situation. What about the government? Government slows things down. Government slows things down, and sometimes government makes it impossible for people to transition from one to another. What I've got is I've got a list here of things. I don't know if I'll get through them all. I'm certainly not going to do justice to all of them in I guess, 35 minutes, because I've got 45 minutes to go, rather 45 minutes total, and I've got 35 to go. I've been at it for about 10 minutes. A lot of this stuff comes from this book of mine, Labor Economics from a Free Market Perspective. Isn't that a pretty book? It's a really good weapon. If you have an enemy, you could bash him over the head with this. It weighs a ton. So a lot of the stuff I have to say is from this book. Not all of it, and I'll be saying stuff not in the book, and I certainly can't go through a whole book of, I don't know, almost 400 pages, but, you know, I'll sort of hit the high points. So how does government screw up things? How does government bollocks up the works? Well, I've got listed the Austrian business cycle theory, minimum wage laws, unions, the Community Reinvestment Act, Obamacare, the Fed, fractional reserve banking. And what else do I have here? Oh, yeah, all sorts of imposed extra benefits when the government is trying to help you. You know, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you. That's supposed to be a joke. Of course, when, you know, an economist tells a joke and no one laughs, it's sort of like when a bear plays the violin and rides a unicycle. You don't ask, is the bear in tune? You say, wow, a bear riding a unicycle, playing the violin. Isn't that great? Well, when an economist tells a pathetic joke, you sort of laugh, even though it's not funny, because, you know, an economist telling a joke, it's amazing. Okay, so let's take some of these extra benefits. The first extra benefit I would mention is unemployment insurance. Now, unemployment insurance sounds sort of good. You know, if you're unemployed, you have insurance, and okay, so you're not working, but at least you're getting some money. Not so bad. But the point is, we have upward sloping supply curves in economics. Namely, the more you offer for something, the more of it you'll get. If you offer 10 cents for a lime of bean, you'll get so many lime of beans. If you offer a dollar more, if you offer $10, you'll get more lime of beans. Supply curves slope upward. Well, the more you pay unemployed people, the more unemployed people you'll have. If you pay unemployed people 50% of their previous wage, well, then, you know, you'll some people would rather work for 50% and have all that leisure. If you offer 5% of the wage, you'll have less unemployment because a lot of people can't get by with 5%. If you offer 150% of the previous wage, pretty much everyone will be unemployed except for a few people who love their jobs, such as me and others, and who would do it for free anyway, and we'll still keep working, and we wouldn't take unemployment insurance because we love our jobs. But we're really not working. We're sort of playing and getting paid like professional athletes or musicians or actors. Let's say they love their job and would do it anyway. But forget about that group of people, it's a very small percentage of the labor force, unemployment insurance is one of the causes of unemployment. If the government wants to have less unemployment, they should lower the unemployment insurance. Now, you could have unemployment insurance privately, but it really wouldn't work out too well because unemployment is something that is almost in total control of the worker. I mean, you know, if the worker wants to quit, he just gets fired and, you know, goes like this to the boss or something, and or maybe like that, and then the boss fires him and he gets unemployment insurance, and you'd have to pay very, very high premiums to get unemployment insurance from a private insurer. I suppose it could be done, but I don't think it ever has been done, as a matter of fact, because of this practical difficulty. But when government gives unemployment insurance, it just increases the amount of unemployment. If we cut out unemployment insurance totally, and people had to live on savings or charity or borrowing from their friends, they would find a way to get a job a lot more. It would, you know, it would focus your attention. It's sort of like when somebody pulls a gun on you. Where's the gun? Here's my gun. If somebody pulls a gun on you, it focuses your attention. Well, if you're not getting any money from unemployment insurance, your attention on getting a job is a lot better focused. Another one is they have all sorts of extra benefits that if a firm is 50 employees or more, then the employees get a whole bunch of extra benefits that they wouldn't get. So, you know, a lot of firms end up having 49 employees, which doesn't really help much of anything. Another one is the government mandates benefits for full-timers. If you're full-time, then the government then the government makes the employer pay all sorts of things like healthcare and whatnot. So you get a lot of part-time people, which is really part-time work when people want full-time work, and when the employer would have given them full-time work, really should sort of count as unemployed. So those are three extra benefits which end up in having firms on the short side of 50 employees or part-timers instead of full-timers, or a lot of people just getting unemployment insurance or welfare. Welfare is a sort of unemployment insurance. It's not exactly unemployment insurance, but it's not unrelated to it. Okay, so that's one source. Let me now mention the Austrian business cycle theory as another source of unemployment. What the Austrian business cycle theory says is that when the government artificially lowers the interest rate, what it does is it sends a signal to entrepreneurs, to businessmen, to invest in more roundabout methods of production than they would otherwise have invested in had they not artificially lowered the interest rate. The interest rate is sort of a market signal. So they invest in more roundabout methods of production. They invest in long-term capital equipment to a greater extent than they otherwise would have, and they take money away from the retail and they push it toward the wholesale and toward the manufacturing and toward mining. So we get to mention two industries that are relevant nowadays. You get too much housing and too many cars, because houses and cars are long-lived kinds of things. Not only do they live long in terms of the consumer, but they take a long time to make if you count the time from the steel and, you know, the bricks and all that stuff. So we have too much investment in certain things and not enough investment in other things, and this can't continue. The government eventually has to stop this money creation, which is the way that they lower the interest rate, because if they don't stop this, then we get into a crack-up boom like Germany in 1923. So they have to stop that. Plus, I think Hayek or somebody wrote a thing, a tiger by a tail, you're holding a tiger by a tail. It's a very precarious sort of a situation, because expectations play a role here. If prices keep going up, people expect prices to go up, and then they have to create even more money, so you get into the sort of roller coaster kind of a thing. So that's one source of unemployment. The reason it's a source of unemployment is because we don't have instantaneous adjustment. If we had instantaneous adjustment, the Austrian business cycle theory paradoxically wouldn't end up in unemployment. It would end up in misallocated resources. It would end up in a GDP lower than it otherwise would have been. It would end up in all sorts of other bad things. But it wouldn't end up in unemployment because we had instantaneous adjustment. So people leave the heavy industries and they go into the light industries. It's sort of as if the governments are, right now, the allocation of resources between, I don't know, chocolate and carrots is appropriate. At least I don't know any reason to think that we have a misallocation of resources between chocolate and carrots. Let's say we want chocolate and carrots 1-to-1 ratio. Don't ask me for the dimensions. Okay, a pound of chocolate to a pound of carrots. And somehow the government artificially stimulates chocolate, and you have more people working in chocolate and fewer people working in carrots. First of all, there was unemployment there because you had to switch out of carrots and into chocolate. Secondly, let's say the government stops this because it can't continue, and then we have to get people back out of chocolate and into carrots. And given that it takes time to find jobs and to fire people and all that, so you have unemployment just on that level. So paradoxically, the Austrian business cycle theory need not end up in unemployment, although it always does because of this lack of instantaneous adjustment. Okay, the next one is, let me skip here and go to Obamacare. Why would Obamacare create unemployment? I mean, you know, one is in the health industry and one is unemployment. What do they have to do with each other? Well, it's very unclear as to what's going on with Obamacare. How much will the employer be responsible for the health care responsibility of his employees? So when people don't know these things, they are sort of like deer caught in the headlights. They don't know what to do. They're sort of frozen. And they figure, well, you know, if I hire somebody, especially full-time, I don't know what I'll be responsible for when Obamacare comes in. So maybe I better not hire anyone full-time. Maybe I'll hire part-time people, or I'll keep the people I've got and give them overtime or something like that. So that creates unemployment. While I'm on healthcare, let me just mention that the reason that we have the crisis of healthcare, well, maybe I shouldn't. Oh, what the hell, I'll spend 2 minutes on it. If you don't like it, too bad. I don't know why I'm getting so silly. Who knows? The reason we have the health crisis, a part of it is because the government had maximum wage laws. During World War II, we had the labor shortages and wages were rising, and the government didn't want wages to rise. Don't ask. So the way to get around that is employers started offering extra things. Like, you know, sometimes when they don't allow banks to charge, to give high enough interest rates, what the banks do to get around this is they give free toasters or free TVs or something like that. Or when the airlines weren't allowed to compete on the basis of price, what they did is they competed on the beauty of the stewardesses and the shortnesses of their miniskirts. Well, when you had maximum wages set under equilibrium prices, there was an employee shortage, and employers wanted to hire employees and couldn't get them because traditionally the way to get employees when you don't have enough is to offer to raise the wage. But if it's illegal to raise the wage, what you do is you give them a toaster or a TV or a miniskirt or something, but they didn't choose that. What they chose to give them is, wait for it, drum roll, health care. I don't know why it was healthcare. They could have given them cars. They could have given them, I don't know what, toys or something, but they gave them healthcare. And that's how somehow healthcare became attached to employment. Don't ask me why. I mean, in an alternative universe where the government didn't do that or where they did it, but the employers came up with a different goodie to give to people to get around this law, healthcare wouldn't have been associated with it. They might have given them cars for all I know, and then we'd have a different kind of a car crisis. Okay, enough for Obamacare. The Community Reinvestment Act is another one that I mentioned in the advertising for this webinar. Well, the Community Reinvestment Act was this thing where the Fed of Boston decided that banks were being racist, because black people weren't getting a proportionate number of mortgages, and whites were getting more. They forgot to mention that Orientals were getting even more mortgages, and therefore if there was any racism here, it was not pro-white and anti-black, but pro-Oriental and anti-white and anti-black. But it's nonsense. It's just that what the banks do is they look for credit ratings and employment history and Do you have a fixed address? Do you have a job? Can you pay 20% of the thing as a down payment of the housing price? And on that basis, Orientals had the best record, whites had an intermediate record, and blacks had the worst record. So they said, well, you know, they're racist. So they, HUD and Fannie and Freddie and all these guys got together and they told the banks that you guys better shape up and start giving loans to people that that really don't deserve it under the old regime, people who can't pay the mortgage. And at that time, housing prices were rising. So people would buy it even though they were in over their heads because they thought that the housing prices would rise and they'd flip the house. And then what happened is that the air went out of the balloon or the housing crisis, housing boom crashed. And now you have a lot of people underwater. That means that the value of their house is less than the mortgage. They owe a $300,000 mortgage and the house is worth $200,000. So this is sort of a crisis and this has created all sorts of necessary shift. There's a vast unemployment in housing construction. So again, if there was instantaneous movement, if people could instantaneously get another job, so who cares if you lose your job in construction, you get in somewhere else. But if there's no instantaneous adjustment, then you, masses of people lose their jobs in the construction industry due to this screw up by HUD and Fannie and Freddie and the Fed. Well, that exacerbates unemployment as well as creates a housing crisis and a banking crisis. Similarly with the Fed and fractional reserve banking, that's just another source of destabilization. If you look at the Fed came in what, 1913, I think it was. Well, we're now about 100 years after 1913. We're in 2012. And if you look at the 100 years before and 100 years after the Fed, the oscillations were gigantic in the Fed period in the last 100 years, whereas before there were oscillations. We didn't have full free enterprise, but we had some vestiges of it. So the oscillations were much less. So what the Fed is doing is destabilizing the economy. And as we said, when there's no instantaneous adjustments, any destabilization creates unemployment. So the Fed is sort of a destabilization machine. It exacerbates oscillations, and when it exacerbates oscillations, it also exacerbates unemployment. Okay, I'm sort of checking off my list here. I've got two more on my list. Oh, and then I've got a whole bunch of things that I don't think create unemployment, except not permanently. Let me go over these last two, and then I'll end my 45 minutes with rejection of other hypotheses such as immigration, population increase, new innovations, things like that. Okay, so the next one is minimum wage law. Why does the minimum wage law create unemployment? Well, before we can answer that, we have to ask, well, what determines wages? Why do people have the wages that they do? Why does the janitor make, I don't know, $8 an hour? Why does the middle class guy make $25 an hour? And why does LeBron James, a basketball player, why does he make, I don't know what he makes, $20 million, $40 million a year, and I don't know how many minutes he plays basketball, but just pick a number out of a hat, don't hold me to it, probably makes $500 an hour, maybe more, probably $2,000 an hour, for all I know. Maybe it's $2,000 a minute, I'm not sure. He makes a lot of money. Why this vast disparity of wages between the poor or the working class, the middle class, and these 1% types? Well, it's because of marginal revenue product or diminishing discounted marginal revenue product, which I have a chapter in this book on, but I'm not going to get into that. That's sort of a complicated issue, maybe during the question period. But marginal revenue product. Well, what is marginal revenue product? Marginal revenue product is how much does the marginal or extra worker add to the bottom line of the employer? So suppose you have, I don't know, 100 employees, and together they're making $10,000 worth of widgets or pens or shoes or whatever it is. And now you hire the 101st worker, and other things are constant. Nothing else changes, stipulate. And all of a sudden, instead of $10,000 an hour, you have $10,010 per hour. So what you do is you attribute the extra $10 an hour to this 101st worker, and you say that the marginal revenue product of the 101st worker is $10 an hour. Now, in actual point of fact, people don't come with a little thing on their forehead that says $10 an hour marginal revenue product. You have to guess that. But if you guess it accurately, you make more money, and if you guess it poorly, you don't make money. I mean, you know, when you draft basketball players, sometimes you pick a real good one, and other times you pick a real, real good one, and his knee goes out and he can't play. Well, you know, there's a skill in picking basketball players, there's a skill in picking plumbers, there's a skill in picking professors, there's a skill in picking everything. So let's leave that to the side and just say that here we have a guy with $10 an hour marginal revenue product. Well, what will his wage be? Well, there are three choices. One, it'll be $15 an hour, namely more, or it'll be, say, $6 an hour, namely less, or it'll end up being $10 an hour equal to his wage, equal to his marginal revenue product. Well, why can't it be an equilibrium situation? Why can it not long endure to pay people $15 an hour who are producing $10 an hour for you? Well, that's a very straightforward question, not too difficult to see, because you're going to lose $5 an hour on these workers. And if you hire a lot of workers and pay them $5 an hour more than they produce for you, well, you're going to go broke. As simple as that, unless, of course, the government bails you out, but that's a whole other issue. Suppose you offer the guy $6 an hour, and he's producing $10 an hour worth for you. You're making a profit off of his work after his blood, sweat, and tears of $4 an hour. Can that last? Well, no, that can't last either, because someone else will offer him $6.01, because they'll say, well, I applaud exploiting workers, you know, and you're getting $10 out of them and he's only being paid $6 an hour. Theoretically, I applaud this, but I'd rather make $3.99 by paying him $6.01 rather than you dirty rat employer, my competitor, making $4 an hour off of him. But then someone else is going to come along, and guess what? Yep, they're going to say $6.02. Well, where will this end? I mean, $6.03, $6.04, $6.25, $7.08. It'll keep going up until that point where the cost of finding the worker and getting them to your factory dissipate the attempt to hire him. This is why growers from California, Utah, Colorado go down to Mexico with big buses and big trucks, because the workers, when they pick, are worth $7 or $8 an hour, and they're being paid 50 cents an hour down there. And they're a big bargain, so they're raising their wage toward their productivity level. So remember, I said there were three choices. The wage could be above productivity, below productivity, or equal to productivity. And I rejected above, and I rejected below. The only option is equal. And when it's equal to productivity, then there are no profits. But the lure of profits gets us there, and we're in equilibrium. And in equilibrium, there are no profits. So wages tend to equal marginal revenue profits. Okay, so here we have a guy making producing $10 an hour worth and having a wage of $10 an hour, and now what we do is we impose a minimum wage law of $12 an hour. It's a nice round number, 10, 12. I know the real minimum wage law is now like 7.35 or something like that, but the progressives, our friends on the left, are always talking about a $10 thing, and soon they'll want $12. So here we have a minimum wage of $12 an hour, and a worker is worth 10. Are you going to hire him? Well, no. Because if you hire him at $12 an hour and he's producing $10 an hour for you, you're losing $2 an hour and you're going to go broke. So that's certainly a cause of unemployment. I don't care what you say. I don't see how that can be denied. In this book, what I've got is sort of a hole of shame. I've got about five pages of very, small type. And I've got a list of about 500 economists who signed a petition saying the minimum wage law is great and we should have more minimum wages. I mean, they're really despicable. I mean, the average guy in the street doesn't know about this, and he votes for it. He thinks that the minimum wage law is sort of like a floor under wages, and the higher it goes, the higher wages go. No, it's really a barrier over which you have to jump to get a job, and the higher the barrier goes, the harder it is to get a job. these people are really despicable. They ought to take their PhDs away from them. There's this guy, what's his name, Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize winner, and he's one of the signatories, and he was asked by some reporter, he said, well, you know, in your textbook, you give the ordinary, story about minimum wage laws, namely the one I've been giving, namely it creates unemployment, and how come you signed this thing? And he went on, Stiglitz went on for 5 minutes explaining this, and I couldn't understand a word he was talking about. I mean, the reporter had Stiglitz with his pants down around his ankles. He was, the emperor was naked, or the economist was naked. And I just don't understand these people, how they could do it. I mean, Krugman and Stiglitz and all these lefty progressive, they're really a disgrace to their PhDs, and the PhD ought to be taken away from them if there were any justice. What else do we have? Oh yeah, let me give you one example. There was this great example. I forget what year it was, something around 1945 or something, maybe 1950. And the minimum wage started in the 30s at 25 cents an hour, and then it went up to 30, 35, 40, and then it was 40 for a while, 40 cents an hour. And then they raised it from 40 cents to 70 cents. And this was the highest percentage raise of the minimum wage ever, almost a doubling. Previous to that and after that, the minimum wage creeps up, but by a percentage rate much smaller than almost double. So the minimum wage went up from 40 cents to 70 cents an hour. During those days, if you walked into a high-rise building and get into an elevator, there was this guy standing there. He wasn't a pervert. He was working there. And what was he doing? He was the elevator operator. There were such things as manually operated elevators. For those of you who aren't into this, or people who don't know what a typewriter is, go look it up or watch a black and white movie, and you'll actually see people in elevators pushing you up into the right floor. Well, how many of these elevator operators were fired the next day after the minimum wage law? They were all making 40 cents an hour, give or take. How many of them got fired the very next day? None of them. Not a one. Remember, no instantaneous adjustments. So the minimum wage sort of looked good. I mean, an elevator operator is making 40 cents an hour, and the minimum wage law goes to 70, and now he's paid 70, and he says, hot diggity dog, whoop-dee-doo, this is great. Thank God for the government. Thank God for minimum wage laws. This is wonderful. Almost doubled my salary. But then what happened is automatic elevators started to be put in. You see, automatic elevators, we had the technology for them then, but they couldn't compete against elevator operators with less sophisticated capital equipment at 40 cents. But at 70 cents an hour, now the automatic elevators could compete with manually operated elevators. And one by one, the manually operated elevators were replaced, and it took 4 or 5 years, and all of a sudden there's no manually operated elevators, and people said, well, it's due to technology, or it's due to the interest rate, or it's due to God knows what. No, it was due to the minimum wage. I remember when I was a kid, you pull into a filling station, and you're attacked by, I don't know, five people. One of them puts the gas in your gas tank, one of them checks the tire pressure, another one checks the, I don't know what, water in the battery, and two or three of them wash all the windows, and that was the way they would learn the job of being a mechanic. They were apprentices, in effect, you know, and then when the car had to be repaired, they would hand the guy the wrench, and they'd look over his shoulder, and they'd learn how to do it. Well, when you had the minimum wage, we moved from, self-serve from a previous situation where people would serve you. So we lost all sorts of jobs there at the bottom of the economic pyramid. The economic or employment pyramid is sort of like a ladder, and the minimum wage law cuts off the bottom rungs of the ladder, so unskilled workers, it's hard for them to get a job because they can't prove that they work well, they can't demonstrate. I mean, at that level, a lot of the jobs consist of, or the success in the jobs consist of coming to work on time and listening to the boss and not fighting with the customers, things like that. And at a minimum wage, you could take a chance on an unskilled, untried worker. But at a high minimum wage, again, the higher it is, the harder it is for these people to get jobs. You might ask, well, why, if the minimum wage law is such a bad thing, if it attacks the unskilled workers, and the lefties are always pushing this thing called social justice at us, and social justice means helping the poor. I gotta get some drugs into me. It's just H2O drug, but, you know, in case Obama's watching, it's legal drug. And the cough drops I'm sucking on are also legal. I'm not into drugs, you know. Although I think they should be legalized, but that's a different subject, so we won't get into that. What was I talking about? Oh, yeah, unions. Oh, if the minimum wage law is such a bad thing and it hurts the poor, why do all the lefties favor it? Well, the reason is because they have this beloved institution called unions of organized labor, and organized labor loves minimum wage law. And you might wonder why. I mean, the union worker is making $20-$25 an hour. Why is he so intent to raise it from $7.25 to $8 an hour? Or why are they pushing for this humane wage of $10 an hour? Well, the reason is every time the union asks for a wage increase, the reaction or the attitude of the employer is, well, how can I substitute out of this suddenly more expensive factor production and into a less expensive factor production? Look, if you were making robots and you could make them out of plastic or steel and the price of steel rose, you would make more plastic robots. Well, if the price of skilled labor rises, your natural tendency is to substitute unskilled labor for it. There are no fixed proportions. You don't have to do it in a certain proportion of skilled and unskilled. So instead of having 10 skilled workers and 100 unskilled workers, you get 5 skilled workers and 200 unskilled workers, to just pick numbers out of a hat. If the union starts asking for an increase or demanding an increase, you just fire some of them and hire unskilled workers. The union doesn't like that. And what they used to do is try to beat up the people after they call them a scab. And I'm not sure why that isn't hate speech, but somehow it's not hateful to call workers who want to work at a low wage or scabs. The problem for the union is the scabs fight back, and it's sort of low, you know, even if you win a fight, you get blood on you. So they came up with this much better way of doing it, namely have a minimum wage law. Unemploy them, price them out of the market, make it impossible to hire unskilled workers so you don't have to beat them up. And since the progressives and the lefties and the socialists love unions, they love the minimum wage law, because unions love the minimum wage law, and they forget all about the poor, who is supposed to be their focus. Okay, I've still got a few minutes, so let me talk about, now that I've discussed minimum wage, I'm checking them off my list. Is unemployment created by immigration, or by population increases, or by new innovation? Well, yes and no. Yes, temporarily. If you have immigrants coming into the country, of course there'll be unemployment until they figure out, you know, to get jobs, and some of them will take the place of other extant workers, and they'll have to find other places. So, yes, temporarily that'll cause unemployment. Anything will cause unemployment temporarily, given no instantaneous adjustment. Population increase, sure. New babies become 18, and now they want to get a job, and they have to find out where they can work. Of course, that'll create unemployment, too. How about new innovation? There's this wonderful movie that I show my freshman economics students called Man in the White Suit. Wonderful movie. Somebody invents a white suit, and this white suit never needs to be cleaned and never needs repairs. It's indestructible. And it'll unemploy the whole industries of clothing and rugs and anything made with cloth. And all these people will be unemployed. And what you get is... the businessmen are chasing him to kill him, and the unionists are chasing him to kill him. Everyone tries to kill him because he's creating this new white suit, and this will create unemployment. Well, that would have been great if the white suit really worked. It would free labor from people who were working in the cloth industries, and there were many people in the cloth industries cleaning it and cleaning it. And there was this old laundry woman said, well, I get a job. And the answer to her is, shut up, lady, you know, you'll be richer because we don't need you to do cloth, you know, you could cook or God knows what. I mean, that's why we're so rich, because, you know, we don't have horses and buggies anymore. We don't have, when you dig a a hole for a new building and excavation, you don't have people with picks and shovels, hundreds of them. You have five guys with a steam shovel, and they can do the work of hundreds of people. We have trains that, you know, 500 cars, and, you know, we could have had jobs for 5 million people taking stuff from Florida to Seattle. So, yes, these new things will create temporary unemployment, but not permanent unemployment. As soon as the people adjust to the new invention, we'll have no more unemployment. Well, it's now about 45 minutes. And I was told to go on for 45 minutes, so now I'll stop, and I'll ask for questions. And Danny, if you're still with me and I'm doing anything wrong, please call me and tell me I'm doing something wrong, and I'll change what I should be doing. But what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go to this little list here, the Q&A, not the chat one. There's plenty of chatting going on. I'm going to go to the Q&A and go to the top of the list. And I don't understand this. Jock Coates says like this, and Chris Branco says yes, and John Katsanos says, how would a gold standard affect the capital formation and national savings rate? I'm not sure about that. Gold standard, how would a gold standard affect the capital formation and national savings rate? Wow. Well, let me take a stab at it. I never really thought about that. I don't know that it's exactly on labor economics, but what the heck, it's all grist for the mill. Well, here's my first shot at it. I don't know if it's right or not, but I'm just sort of taking a guess. Well, if we had a gold standard, we'd have a lot less oscillations from the Fed. The gold standard is like handcuffs on the Fed. And the Fed couldn't work. I assume the Fed would either be gone or be much less powerful. So we wouldn't have as many oscillations, and we wouldn't have, and we'd be a lot richer. So how would that affect the capital formation? Well, we'd have more capital. And the national savings rate, well, we'd have more savings. I don't know about the rate. I guess the rate depends upon time preference. And as we get rich, I don't know which way time preference goes. I don't think praxeologically you can say, when you double your wealth or triple your wealth, whether the savings rate will increase or not, probably it would increase as a phonological insight. I don't think you could say praxeologically. I think I wrote a paper saying just that. So my answer is a gold standard would increase capital formation because we're richer, and probably, phonologically, would increase the savings rate and would certainly increase the quantity of savings. Okay, the next question is Dan Rose. Just wanted to test this out. No questions yet. I don't know what to say about that. What about Green Proudhon's idea of mutual banking enabling workers low-cost access to capital instead of bosses? That's a good one. I did discuss syndicalism and mutual, companies, and I said that the employer gives three things, one leadership, two time, and three, risk. He takes the risks. So I wouldn't think that the Proudhon's idea of mutualism or syndicalism would work out too well in banking or any other industry. However, as a libertarian, I could say, look, if they want to try it. I don't care. If the workers want to band together and get their own capital and take their own risk, that's perfectly compatible with free enterprise, so I wish them the best of luck. I don't think as a predictor, as an economist who is forecasting, I don't think it would work out too well because of the fact that the workers don't want to bear the risk. The workers don't want to spend a year's salary until the first things come off the assembly line. And whether it's banking or any other industry, I don't see why that would matter. So I think I've already answered that. Ah, here's a good one. Could you explain monopsony? And is there a small use for unions as Hazlitt states in Economics in One Lesson? Great statement by Hazlitt. The end is production. The means is full employment. Well, let me take the latter part first. You see, what we want, we don't want jobs. What we want is production. I mean, suppose you had a job where you dug a hole and filled it up again. At the end of the day, you might have had a little bit more muscle, but you have no product. Well, we'd all starve if everyone had a job like that. So we don't want jobs, particularly. Jobs are, what is it, a necessary evil. What we'd like is to be able to play, namely work and enjoy it, and not do things we don't enjoy. But what we need from jobs is a productivity. So, Ron Paul wants to get rid of 5 departments in the federal departments. I forget which ones. I'm having a Rick Perry moment. I can't think of the 5 ones he wants to get rid of. But one objection to this is, well, if you get rid of these jobs, we'll create unemployment. And Ron Paul's proper answer is, well, we don't want any old employment. We want employment that creates product. These jobs in the government not only don't create product, they reduce product because the people working for these agencies make it harder for other people to produce things. So we don't want those kind of jobs. We want jobs that create productivity. Okay, so that's the second part of this question. The first part is monopsony. Now, with regard, there's really 3 parts. Haslow has a small use for unions. I'm not against unions per se. If a union, and I should have gone into this, but I only had 45 minutes, so you can't do everything. There is such a thing under libertarian theory, not Austrian theory now, but under libertarian theory, there is such a thing as a legitimate union. If the union limits itself to a mass quit, that's fine. Look, if an individual goes to the boss and says, hey, boss, double my salary, I leave, the boss says, my way or the highway, rots a rock in your new job. But if the guy comes in and says, I represent all 500 of your workers, and we all want, a 5% wage increase or something, now the employer has to start thinking, well, if I fire all 500 of them, I'm going to get new 500, and that's going to take a while for them to organize and be a good team. So maybe I'll give them the wage. So the demand curve is sort of not a thin line, but a thick line. Okay, so there might be some benefit in what do they call it, collective bargaining. So if you can't quit your job, you're a slave. That indeed was really the only problem with slavery. Otherwise, slavery wasn't so bad. You could pick cotton, you could sing songs, they give you gruel. It was fine. I'm kidding. Honest. Don't quote me out of context here. I'm not coming out in favor of slavery. Well, except voluntary slavery, but that's a whole different issue. The problem with real slavery is you couldn't quit. When the oldest of you started whipping you, you couldn't say, oh, well, it was a nice job for a while, but I quit. That was the problem with it. So if you can't quit, you're a slave. Well, if one worker can quit, and no one says one worker can't quit, well, then why can't all 500 of them quit together en masse? And if that's all the union did, well, it would be a legitimate organization. It would have some power, some legitimacy. But unions do more than that. Not only do they want to quit, they want to prevent other people from taking their jobs. And that is illegitimate because we have, the rights of the worker pre-association. If the workers want to quit, the employer should be able to hire someone else. Look, to make an analogy here, divorce is a problem. It's a personal tragedy. But when a guy divorces his wife, it's okay. It's one thing. But when he gets his friends to surround his ex-wife's house, and anyone who she tries to date instead of him, he beats them up. Well, that's what the union does, and that's illegitimate. So if Hazlitt means the union's illegitimate in this sense, fine. But I think that my recollection of what Hazlitt says, he thinks they have a proper role, a limited role, and I don't go along with that. About monopsony. Now, monopsony is sort of the opposite of monopoly. And for the Austrians, monopoly is a special grant of privilege from the government. It doesn't matter how many companies are in monopoly. We don't care about Herfindahl indices, and we don't care about 8 firm concentration ratios or anything like that. When Alcoa was the only single producer of aluminum, or IBM was the only producer of, computers, or the New York Times, say, was the only newspaper in New York City, that wasn't true, but if it were true, the question is it illegal to compete with the New York Times or Alcoa or IBM? And it wasn't, so there was no monopoly. Monopsony is a single buyer instead of a single seller. And the idea, the usual example people give is Hershey, Pennsylvania, where 99% of the jobs in Hershey, Pennsylvania were making chocolate. And the idea here is, I don't have a blackboard, I can't explain it, but whoever asked this question, if you email me at wblock.com, No, wblock at loyno, L-O-Y-N-O dot E-D-U. I think my email is out there. I wrote an article on monopsony, co-authored with my friend and many times co-authored Bill Barnett on monopsony. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because there are many other questions, but if you really want to dig in on the monopsony, email me and I'll send you this article. And then if that doesn't explain it, you can ask me about it. Monopsony is the idea that just as the monopolist exploits the worker, so does the monopsonist, and therefore you can have a minimum wage within a certain gap, and if it's in that gap, it can actually raise wages and increase employment. It's all utter nonsense, but I can't do justice to the question without a blackboard and without really a whole hour describing how the monopsony diagram works. So I'm going to have to not do full justice to your question. I'm sorry. Next one, on unemployment insurance, do you think it's more like a wage and price control, keeping people from working to keep wages up? No, I don't think it's like a price control. It's more like a subsidy, a farm subsidy or a bailout. I don't think it's a wage and price control. A wage and a price control is what Murray Rothbard would call triangular intervention. Namely, the government tells A and B what they can do or what they can't do, or it compels them or prohibits them from doing certain things. So that would be a wage or a price control, triangular intervention. Whereas unemployment insurance is not keeping people from working to keep wages up, but rather unemployment insurance is a subsidy for unemployment. So it's a little different. Next one is Bob Trumbo, impact of new Indiana right-to-work legislation. Well, right-to-work legislation, it's sort of like a second best from the libertarian point of view, but really, the way to deal with unions is not to have a right-to-work law which prohibits union shops, where a union, you can only get a job if you work in the union, and people who aren't in the union but are employed, maybe grandfathered in, have to pay union dues even though they're not members of the union. That's sort of a second best way of getting these rascals, these criminals, these unionists. Unions are criminal gangs. And I can't be all against anything that bashes them. But a much better way to deal with unions is not to prohibit unions per se, but to prohibit unions from using initiation of force, whether legal force through Wagner Act and Taft-Hartley Act and other things like that, or by beating up scabs. So I think a much better way to attack unions, evil unions, is to attack them at their source or their core. Whereas I think this is sort of a glancing blow. It's not right in the bullseye of unions. Next one, impact of sticky wages. Well, you know, I didn't mention sticky wages, but I didn't mention them specifically, explicitly, but implicitly I've been, half of my lecture was on sticky wages when I said that any change requires, it's not instantaneous. Well, that's what sticky wages are. The wages are not instantaneous. They're sticky, even in the market. But in the market, if the government isn't creating any havoc, well, then, you know, sticky, eventually they move. And when they don't move, people lose money for not moving them, and they're encouraged to move them. I would like your thoughts on managing base pay in a highly inflationary environment like Argentina. I don't know what to say about that. I'm not really a manager. I'm more of an economist. I'm not an advisor to business. I guess if I wore that hat, I guess in a highly inflationary environment, you have to keep increasing the wages. Otherwise, you lose workers. I mean, in Germany, 1923, or in Zimbabwe, we had this hyperinflation. Every day you have to give people, every hour you have to give them a wage increase, otherwise they'll leave because prices are going up and wages are going up. So I guess that would be my guess at managing base wages, pay them more. Andrew Helm, in the theory of the Austrian business cycle, what are the key indicators that the economy has overheated or crashed from artificial interest rates that can no longer be sustained from government stimulus? That's a very good question. I guess the key indicator is unemployment, vast unemployment. That would surely, or the stock market falling apart like it did in, what was it, October 29, these would certainly be indicators that we're about ready to crash. Roger Garrison, who's sort of leading Austrian in this, talks about what is it that the entrepreneurs think that the savers are saving 10 bricks, but they're only saving 9 bricks, so they set up companies that require 10 bricks, and then they get up to the 9th floor and they don't have bricks for the 10th floor. That would be an indication also. We have three-quarter finished buildings. That would certainly be an indication of an Austrian business cycle. Armand Tadnia in Sweden. The government has lowered the interest rate on student loans while they simultaneously reduced the number of student seats in college, even though the demand for a seat in college has risen to an all-time high. Is that a bubble waiting to burst? That's a good one. So what the government in Sweden is doing in lowering interest rates on student loans is pushing more students into school while they simultaneously reduce the number of seats in college. Well, that's a crazy program. Good old Sweden. Is that a bubble waiting to burst? Well, that's a good question. I wish you'd stop asking me nasty questions that I didn't prepare for, because I'm going to look stupid because I don't really know the answer. I can sort of just bumble my way toward an answer. Not a bubble. Well, I think a bubble is mainly in the private sector. No, that's not true. Sort of bubbles the private sector. So if the government, I don't know, suppose the government just supports cars. Well, they can keep on doing it until you have a revolution. I don't really know. Let me just say it's a stupid policy. Wait, I got a phone call. Maybe it's Danny. Hello, Danny? Hello? Yes? Yes? Oh, David, I'm on a webinar. I can't talk. I'll talk to you later. Sorry, it was somebody else. Danny said he'd call me if I was doing something wrong, so I thought that was Danny, but it's my nephew David, so I couldn't talk to him. Okay, next question, now that I screwed up that one. Napoleon Cole. I'm interested in how one might determine the price, in quotes, of leisure time across groups. Block speaks about the decision to engage in leisure in relation to unemployment insurance payments. I don't know, boy, I hate to seem so stupid, but I'm not sure about this one either. I don't think that there's an explicit price of leisure. Nobody pays you, so there can't be an explicit price. I guess there's an implicit price of leisure. Namely the alternative that you could have for leisure. In other words, if I'm at leisure, I'm sitting in my hammock, swaying, and you know, just sort of spacing out. What price am I paying? Well, I'm paying the price of my next best alternative. What's my next best alternative? It could have been riding a bike or swimming or reading or God knows what. And it could also be the salary I could have made. So if I guess the price of anything is the next best alternative, unless it's an explicit price in the market. Napoleon Cole, part two. But what about leisure compared to the scarcity levels that an advanced economy produces? Relatively small savings plus access to Walmart cheap goods plus ownership of a house plus the Gandhi mentality creates very little reason to work. Well, great. I'm in favor of very little reason to work. I'm against work. Work is evil. Work is a necessary evil. Necessary because we need stuff. Somebody's got to clean the toilets and, you know, do the sewage and do other things that we wouldn't do for the fun of them. So I'm in favor of getting rid of work. The ideal situation is no one works. We all play. We all just have a grand old time and manna comes down from heaven. That would be great. And I think if the government got out of the way, we'd move in that direction. We're not going to reach it because there'll always be scarcity, but we want to move in that direction. So I'm not sure what I can do for Napoleon Cole, but he tries again. Part three. Maybe I should skip Napoleon because there are a lot of questions, so I'm going to skip him. I've already given him two shots. I'll come back to him if I run out of stuff. Armand Tajnia is waiting. Sebastian Spitz. How would a carbon tax affect unemployment? Gosh. That's a good one. Where do you people come up with these great questions? Well, any change would create unemployment because of sticky wages or lack of instantaneous adjustment. But in the long run, I don't think a carbon tax would affect unemployment. It would have employment in different areas than it otherwise would. I think you can still have full employment even if we have, double of the income tax. So I don't see that one has anything to do with the other, except in the short run that any change would create in temporary unemployment. But I think the natural tendency is toward full employment unless there's something stopping it, like a minimum wage law or unemployment insurance or things like that. Richard Beloff, isn't it true that anything that slows adoption to change will increase UE? The hell is UE? I don't know what UE is. For example, owning a home makes me less mobile. Maybe UE is unemployment. I don't know. Isn't it true that anything that slows adoption to change will increase unemployment? For example, owning a home makes me less mobile. Yeah, I think that's true. There is no instantaneous adjustment, but anything that increases mobility will reduce unemployment. For example, if we had better cars or better highways or better transportation and people could get from one job to another, that would increase or decrease unemployment. Some people speak about rent control. When you have a rent controlled apartment, you're being heavily subsidized. In New York City, they have rent control, and you get a job in Cleveland that you would otherwise take, but you hate to leave your rent-controlled apartment. I don't think that would increase unemployment. You could still have full employment with owning a home or having rent control, but it would certainly decrease labor mobility. It would decrease the efficiency of labor, but it need not, certainly would not increase unemployment in the long run. Jock Coates. So you would say that structural unemployment can only happen because of state intervention, either regulating jobs out of existence, minimum wage. Yeah, I guess I would. I guess it depends upon how you define structural unemployment, but my view is that there are two sources of unemployment. One is lack of instantaneous adjustment, and the other is government intervention. Professor Block, Sebrin Sierra, please discuss the effects of inflation on unemployment. Assuming revenue is stagnant, it seems that wages keep going up because of increased costs of living. No. I don't think I'd go along with this one. First of all, one effect of inflation on unemployment is it creates the Austrian business cycle, and that creates unemployment, and I've discussed that. But this idea that wages keep going up because of increased cost of living, that's sort of cost-push inflation, and Austrians don't go along with cost-push inflation. We're monetarists in this regard. I mean, I hate to call us a monetarist because Friedman is monopolized, in quotes, that phrase. But I think that wages are based on productivity, and they don't go up because the cost of living increases. Cost of living increases, wages need not go up, you'll just have a lower real income. Manuel Menezes de Siquiera. Some of the Scandinavian countries, I think, do not have minimum wages. Hey, great. They are typically considered socialist or social democratic countries. What explains that? Well, look, you could have, I don't think the Soviet Union had any minimum wages, and they were socialist. I'm not sure about that, but I don't think Cuba or North Korea has minimum wages. I mean, minimum wage is sort of a triangular intervention. It's imposed by government on the employer vis-a-vis the employee. Whereas when the government is the only employer, it pays whatever it thinks, so you don't have a minimum wage. Now, it's interesting. I was a co-author with Gortney and Lawson on this rating economic freedom of all the countries. And Sweden is a very interesting country. It's, I think, the biggest of the Scandinavian countries. And what's going on there is that when it comes to income redistribution, they're really horrible. They're forever having welfare. But other aspects of economic freedom, like they're a relatively small country as world countries go, and they're very, very good on free trade. So the Scandinavian countries are a complicated sort of a thing. In some ways, they're very socialistic, social welfare. In other ways, they're very free enterprise. Certainly international trade, they're very good on that. Annie Ruda Ravi Shankar, Professor Block, what do you say to lefties who say that children of workers earning less and more suffer from relative poverty depressions and suggest that free markets are immoral? What do you say to lefties who say that children of workers earning less and suffer from relative poverty depressions? I'm not sure I understand it, so I'm not sure I can do full justice to it, but if what they mean by depressions is psychological depressions, I think they should go to a good shrink. I'm a fan of Albert Ellis, and my friend Michael Edelstein is one of his chief lieutenants, so I recommend him. Google him at Dr. Edelstein, 3-minute therapy. Relative poverty, I mean, look, right now in the U.S., the poor people, they've got air conditioners, they've got cars, they've got color TVs, they've got baseball mitts, they've got basketballs, they've got, I don't know what they're missing. Okay, they might not have a Rolls Royce, but they got a little car. I remember when I used to watch the Olympics in the 80s, every time someone won a gold medal, they'd interview them. And the Russian guys, they would always interview them sitting in a little red car or sitting in an apartment. And I finally figured out why they were doing that, and that is because in Russia, if you're 22 years old, the age of Olympic gold medal winners, the only way you're going to get a little car of your own is to be an Olympic gold medal winner. Whereas in the U.S., you can get a job at McDonald's and still have your own apartment and a little 8-year-old car. Yes, there's relative poverty because if you work at McDonald's, you're in the lowest decile or the lowest quintile, and you have relative poverty, and if you're depressed, go see a therapist. I guess that's what I have to say about that. A. Smith, are there any big examples of rent-seeking or major rent-seekers currently undermining more market-based job creation? Well, first of all, I take great umbrage at this evil concept of phrase, rent-seeking. What rent-seeking means is crony capitalism, using the political process to gain an advantage over your competitors, get a bailout, and they don't get a bailout, or get a law passed that makes it impossible for them to work, or makes it more difficult, or adds paperwork, and you have economies of scale and paperwork, and they don't. That's evil. That's an abomination. What they really ought to call it is booty seeking, or theft seeking, or plunder or piracy or something, really bad. But these rascals, these public choice pinkos, they use rent-seeking to indicate something which is like the worst possible thing in political economy. Now, rent is a perfectly good thing. Rent, you pay rent for a car, for enterprise, or Hertz, or you rent an apartment. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a perfectly good thing. Or economic rent. LeBron James, they makes $40 million, and his next best option, not in basketball, say he could be a lawyer and make $1 million a year. He's making economic rent of $39 million a year. Well, that's, unobjectionable. Why call it rent-seeking? Okay, so now that I've vented my spleen on rent-seeking, let me answer the question. Are there any big examples of piracy or booty-seeking or major pirates currently undermining more? Yeah, plenty of it. I mean, the bailout in, Detroit is booty-seeking or piracy, and it's certainly undermining, well, not job creation, because you can have plenty of jobs producing cars that no one wants to buy. The key is jobs that create products that people want to buy. So who cares about job creation? What we want is job creation of the sort that creates things that people want to buy. And there are plenty of examples of that. I mean, the Solyndra case where Obama gave untold millions to some sort of green enterprise and it went broke. That would be another example. They had jobs, but they didn't create anything. Dan Rose, from a policy standpoint, what would be the one thing you would enact or repeal to most quickly positively affect the real rate of unemployment? Unemployment insurance? Well, that's an empirical question, and I'm not really into this. I'm not really up on how much unemployment these various things create. My own personal thing, based on not on empirical studies of what does the most harm, would be the minimum wage law. I think that's really despicable because it attacks the people least able to fight back and the people who don't realize that they're being exploited. If I had one thing to do, I'd get rid of, well, maybe unions, maybe minimum wage. I don't know, the Fed. There's a lot of stuff to get rid of. I hope Ron Paul wins and we'll get rid of it all. We won't have to pick which one we want to get rid of. So I really don't know how to answer that question, get rid of them all. But if I had to pick one, maybe the Fed. I don't know. Maybe the IRS. Maybe the Army. Militarism, you know, killing people far away from us. I don't know. That's a good question, though. Peter Twigg. Can you comment on Ron Paul's claim that slashing government would result in a pickup in employment and the economy given the lag effect? I noticed the difference at the end of World War II when there was a huge pent-up demand for consumer products and where consumers, businesses, and government carry massive debt. I agree with Ron Paul. I think he's magnificent. He mentions that at the end of World War II, the lefties, the progressives, the socialists were saying, well, you know, we can't let all the soldiers come back all at once, and we have to have special programs. But before they can enact any of these programs, they all soldiers came back, and there was a boom of 1946. Bob Higgs has done good work on this, showing that the Depression really ended then, not at the beginning of World War II. World War II was not an end of the Depression. So I agree that slashing government, you see, slashing government, like those five, departments that he wants to get rid of, initially would result in the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs. But we don't want jobs. What we want is jobs to create product. And those jobs not only don't create a product, as I said before, they reduce the creation of things that people want to buy on the part of other people. So yes, we have to slash government. And this pent-up demand, I don't think that that's too Keynesian. I don't think that the economy is based on the back of consumers. It's based on the back of producers. Okay, Ryan Schmidt. How much of the rigidity in the U.S. labor market do you think is attributable specifically to the minimum wage rather than other regulations and liabilities that make employers slow? This is another empirical question. I really don't know the answer to that. This could be a good PhD dissertation. It's an empirical study, and I'm not really up on, you know, is the minimum wage worse than unemployment insurance? Someone else asked me that before, and I really couldn't answer it then, and I can't answer it now. I'm sorry. This, by the way, this would be a good thing for empirical economists to do. Austrians aren't against empirical economics. We don't believe that economic regressions test theories, but we certainly believe that they illustrate them. And I invite people who are in graduate school or not to go and do empirical regression equation studies on this sort of a question, which of these things have more of a negative impact. I don't know the answer to that, but these are good questions, and they should be studied. Now, Mark Brown, at one time there was talk that we were moving from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. Is it possible to have an all-service economy? Would the ideal be a mix of manufacturing and service? The ideal is whatever the free enterprise system comes up with. I mean, you know, people say, well, you know, we've got to get out of farming because, you know, prices of farm goods never rise fast. But, you know, Iowa, Kansas, you know, Indiana, well, maybe not Indiana, but some of the farm states are doing fine. Manhattan is a very rich place, and there's no manufacturing or very little manufacturing there. You know, they talk about farming, manufacturing, service, computers. The ideal mix is whatever the market comes up with. And in different places, in New York City, there's the Diamonds Exchange in five square blocks, just diamonds practically. And then there's the Flower Area, there's Wall Street. This is sort of a central planning kind of a question, what should the economy be like? And my answer is, it should be like whatever the market participants want it to be like. James Foy, can you talk a little bit about state-sponsored certification and permit requirements? For example, someone cannot just offer services as a hairdresser, but must get a permit first. That's a real wild one. There's this Institute for Justice, and the hair braiding that some black athletes and other black people have, they have this very, I don't have that problem. I don't think I'm going to be able to go to a hair braider. But they have these 15-year-old girls who are like experts in hair braiding. And people come to them, to black people mainly. I think white people also get hair braiding if they have hair. And most people have got more than I have. I'm follically challenged. The government's got to give a subsidy to us follically. Okay, I'll get back to the questions. These are despicable things. This 15-year-old girl who can hair braid, she shouldn't have to go to hairdressing school for, 20 years. I'm exaggerating. She shouldn't have to get a permit. Anyone who submits their head to her knows what they're getting into, and, she's got many satisfied clients, and I think that's wrong. Permit or permit requirement is for doctors. And before I was talking about Obamacare, and I said one of the problems is that they don't know what the responsibilities are, but another problem is that we license doctors. And now, Milton Friedman is not one of my favorite economists. I think he's a very compromising libertarian, if he's a libertarian at all. But chapter 9, I think, of his book, Capitalism and Freedom, is magnificent on government licensing of doctors. And what you'll find if you do the empirical research, and here I have done a little empirical research, is that doctors make like 5 or 6 times as much as PhD biologists, and the AMA is the strongest union in the country, and they refuse to allow more medical schools to be built or medical schools to take more people, even though there are plenty of people who would give their eye teeth to go to medical school. There was this case that Milton Friedman talks about where they make you foreign doctors, like from Cuba during the Cuban migration, or in the 30s when the Austrian doctors were trying to get away from Hitler, the Jewish doctors. People come from Austria or from Cuba, and the physicists get jobs here, and the mathematicians, and the chemists, and the biologists all get jobs at universities here. The doctors can't get a job because the exam here has to be in English. Now, you might say, well, there's a reason for that, because if the exam isn't in English and I go in there and I say, my shoulder hurts, and the guy starts operating on my knee, that's no good. But that's why God invented translators, is one rebuttal. Another rebuttal is, what about unconscious patients? They can't say anything anyway, so, the doctor is at no disadvantage if he doesn't speak the language. And third, a Cuban doctor can treat fellow Hispanic or Spanish-speaking patients. So this idea is just horrible. We shouldn't have we should have certification, not licensing. When we had thalidomide, which had birth defects but was a good morning sickness pill, the FDA, which didn't prohibit it, should have gone broke. But no, the FDA is still with us, and now instead of allowing bad drugs, they prohibit good drugs. They commit different kind of error. So I'm for free market certification. We should have competition. We should have an industry that engages in certification of things, and then if they do a good job, they'll prosper. If they do a bad job, they'll go broke, and we'll have pretty good certification, whereas with licensing, it doesn't work that way. Sebastian Spitz. Boy, I'm only halfway down the list of questions, and I've only got 7 minutes, so I better go faster, I guess. If the government were to get rid of unemployment insurance without getting rid of the minimum wage, oh, that's a bitch. Wouldn't that result in low-skilled workers who have been unable to find work, but also unable to have their most basic needs met? Yeah, that's true. if the government got rid of unemployment insurance without getting rid of the minimum wage, it would really screw people up. So probably they should get rid of the minimum wage law first, which doesn't allow them to, I mean, that would be almost like the death sentence. Well, there'd be private charity and churches and stuff, but still, that's a very good point, Sebastian Spitz, that you wouldn't want to get rid of unemployment insurance while raising the minimum wage, because then you'd be consigning people to really great misery. John Francois Noel. Free trade between the U.S. and Canada now exists since about 20 years. In your opinion, how did free trade impact both countries and now NAFTA? First of all, there is no free trade between the USA and Canada, nor is NAFTA, which includes Mexico, free trade. These are customs unions. There is a little bit of a reduction in barriers to free trade between these three countries, but there's still plenty of other barriers. Look, whenever you have a free trade agreement, quote, free trade, that's 20,000 pages, that's not a free trade agreement. What we should have is a unilateral declaration of free trade with everybody. Whether or not they have free trade with us, we should have free trade with them. Look, if there are two guys sitting in a rowboat and one guy shoots a hole in the bottom, does it make sense for the other guy to shoot another hole in the bottom? No. Look, if you won't trade with me on food, why should I not trade with you on clothing? I'll still trade with you on clothing. You're just an idiot for not free trading with me. What's his name? Gary Johnson accuses Ron Paul of not being for free trade because he's against NAFTA. And I think Ed Crane of Cato also did that. That's crazy. Ron Paul is the most radical on free trade. And he's against NAFTA because NAFTA isn't free trade, and he's against the agreement between U.S. and Canada. Aniruddha Ravi Shankar. Professor, what would be your suggestion to a 19-year-old freshman aspiring to be an Austrian economist? Come to New Orleans. Come to Loyola University. All of my colleagues are Austrian economists and die-hard free enterprises. No other department our size has 100% free enterprise Austrian libertarian economists. Freshmen, this is an order. You know, I've discovered that it's libertarianism is okay in theory, but if you really want to get something done, you have to threaten people. So I now threaten everyone. Come to New Orleans or I'm going to smack you. I'm just kidding, of course. I'm kidding. Hey, I'm kidding. But seriously, everyone should come here because we have a solid free enterprise department, Dan D'Amico, John Levendis, Bill Barnett, and myself, a very, very good department. We've got money to invite speakers, and we invite good speakers here. This is really, there are some schools that have more free enterprise law students than us, but we have a much higher percentage. So every economics course that you take is going to be free enterprise. Doesn't mean that we ignore the neoclassical Marxists. We bash them, but we do from an Austrian and libertarian point of view. That is a great question. I paid him $15 to ask me that, so thank you. In a recent article attacking Apple, working conditions in Taiwan, Apple's working conditions in Taiwan, are the employees better off having the factory job despite challenging conditions? Well, this is the sweatshop argument or the sweatshop issue. You know, who is that Gifford woman? I forget her name. Mrs. Gifford had Frank Gifford's wife had a sweatshop in Bangladesh or somewhere, and she was paying, 50 cents an hour. And all of the hippie lefties, fair trade types, were saying, oh, this is evil. Mary Lee Gifford? I don't remember. Look, when you set up a sweatshop in an undeveloped country like Taiwan is hardly underdeveloped now, but say Bangladesh or parts of India, Philippines, and you offer 50 cents an hour, what's the prevailing wage? Is it 50 cents? No, it's much less. You get people lining up around the block to get these jobs. When Walmart opened in New Orleans a few years ago, all the lefties were against Walmart opening because, Walmart doesn't do this, it's not unionized, it doesn't pay health care, yak, yak, yak. They wanted 400 employees. They got 4,000 people lining up around the block to get the job. Voting with the feet is a very important indication of of economic welfare. So I'm in favor of sweatshops. I'm in favor of Walmart. I'm in favor of anything between consenting adults. I'm tired of Chris Holloway. I'm just tired of defending free trade. Could you give me a good argument for defending the trade deficit of between U.S. and China? Well, the trade deficit is great. Look, if those idiots are going to give us stuff and they'll take green paper, they're morons. They shouldn't do that if they had their own any sense. Actually, what they do is they take the money and then the money comes back here and we have to give them stuff. There was this great case where the Japanese bought up, Rockefeller Center in New York City for $7 billion or something. And then everyone was saying, oh, you know, we beat them in a war fair and square. Who are these Japanese to think that they can buy up Rockefeller Center, which is emblematic of, you know, New York and the U.S.? Well, as it happened, they lost out because real estate at that time fell and they lost some money. But look, anytime a trade occurs, both parties gain in the ex ante sense. When the Japanese paid $7 billion for Rockefeller Center, they valued it more than $7 billion, otherwise they wouldn't have bought it. And the people who sold it to them valued Rockefeller Center at less than $7 billion, so there was mutual gain. A trade deficit, look, I have a gigantic trade deficit with Walmart. They don't pay me anything, and I buy stuff from them. On the other hand, Loyola, my employer, they have a great trade deficit with me. They pay me and I don't buy anything from them except, you know, once in a while I eat in their cafeteria. I'm sorry to say it's now 7:30 and I think I'm supposed to stop now and I'm sort of running out of voice, although there are a lot of questions here. Danny, I'm not sure what to do, but I think I'm finished. Yeah, 45 minutes of discussion and 45 minutes of lecture. So I'm sort of running out of voice and saliva, so I guess I'll have to end it. It was fun. I enjoyed it very much, and I hope all the people that tuned in got something out of it. Bye. How do I hang up now?